Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between our personal well-being and our total environment. I'm a long-standing journalist of food, health, the environment, social policies, media, and cultural attitudes. And every week on this show, we connect the dots between what we experience subjectively, personally, in our health and our well-being, and what's going on in our greater world, both the health of our communities, the health of our society, the health of our families, the health of the prerequisites for life, food, water, air, earth, warmth, shelter, all of those things. So we cast a very wide net here on Connect the Dots. The show's been ongoing for about 4 years, and it's a pleasure to be with you every week. Anything that we refer to, or if you miss the show or want to pass it along to friends, you can also find in the Connect the Dots archives on PRN. Today's guest and topic is one that I feel is ultimately foundational and fascinating. It basically is kind of the underlying human element that really is kind of in the background but key to why we discuss the things we do on this program and what we can, you know, what we are enlisting people or hoping people will do about it, and how they how that's a challenge and how we can understand that. So today's guest is, and I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, and please correct me if I am not, is Pythia Pei. Is that right, Pia?
That's absolutely exactly right. Thank you.
Okay. Good. I was guessing. Pythia Pia, and Pythia is the editor, author of a fantastic compendium that's going to be our main topic on today's show. She's also written another book, which we will mention and probably have on for another show, because there is so much to discuss in both books that I want to do them full justice. But we'll mention both of them, but we're going to discuss in depth today her new compendium, America on the Couch. And listeners, when you hear the subtitle, you're really, I mean, I think the title alone conveys it, but the subtitle, Psychological Perspectives on American Politics and Culture. This is an incredible book, Pythia, and thank you so much for writing it and gathering it together. It's a series of dozens, really, literally, of interviews with leading psychologists and thought leaders, about looking at, you know, the thing that's kind of there in the background every day in our world, what's going on with us and what's going on in our society and in our cultural attitudes, because there's individual psychology and there's also, you know, cultural attitudes or social attitudes, psychological attitudes that pervade our particular American culture. And that's what the subject of this book is. And so all of these dozens of brilliant thought leaders weigh in on this topic. Everybody from the very, very beloved James Hillman and Marion Woodman, who were like senior sage elders, to Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, who was the first to talk about the zone, Robert J. Lifton, Thomas More, Mary Pfeiffer, Ernst Rossi, you know, many, many contributors that are very well known, and others who may not be so widely known to all of us. Some of them were not so well known to me. So really fascinating. Pythia has interviewed these people, and they each zone in on deep areas of insight about what's going on with us, internally in terms of our social attitudes and how that affects our world and the challenges of the time we live in, which is, of course, a constant and recurring underlying theme at all times on Connect the Dots. So glad to have you here, Pythia. Thank you so much for doing this book and for coming on the show.
Well, thank you, Allison, and thank you for that wonderful introduction that gives people such a great idea of the book. It's a very huge book, too. It's a big, thick book.
Yes,
filled
it is.
With lots of ideas.
Yes, it is. It's massive. I just have to say personally at the outset, I just deeply admire him and very grateful that you did this. It is so, so needed. And it's really interesting being, as one who has worked in the publishing world, written books, and been part of that whole world, this book is a treasure. And I also note that it was published by an independent press, and which is happening more and more. And thankfully, thank God for them that they published it. And it's a great, too bad for the main publishing world that is, mm-hmm. interested in just repeating the same formulaic things over and over, rather than really putting forth a tremendous work and, really needed book as this one is. So let's just dive in a little. I have, sort of singled out a few, in the week or so that I've had it. I must confess I haven't read the entire book, but I have dipped into some of my favorite and most respected people. And so I'm going to ask you, and we'll be talking about certain, specific ones of the interviews and essays and stuff, to kind of begin delving in. The one we're going to begin with is the interview that you did with Mary Pfeiffer about, one of the things that happens on this show all the time is that we're talking about all of the different things that really need our attention as citizens. And yet it's painful to look at those things, painful to realize the struggle we're in, hard to, for many people to engage. Others who do engage, wind up feeling kind of exhausted and burned out. And so that's sort of a subtext of a lot of the reporting and coverage that I do on this program, is how can people get more involved? Why aren't they more involved? So just for those who are not familiar with psychologist Mary Pfeiffer, PhD, whom you interviewed, she's the author of a groundbreaking book called Reviving Ophelia, as well as a bunch of other books. That book is really, really well known and made a big dent. And it turns out that the Keystone XL pipeline, which we've covered on the show, is if built, would go through Pfeiffer's home state of Nebraska. So this is something that Mary Pfeiffer, this brilliant psychologist, has kind of thought about a good deal. And she's a Midwesterner, so she's also thinking about how do we talk to people who are not on the two coasts and tend to be more activist and savvy and blue state, about some of the threats of our time, climate change being a huge one. Of course, the issue with the Keystone XL is that it would greatly accelerate climate change, in the words of James Hansen, the sort of premier climatologist, climate scientist. It would be game over for the environment if it were built. So in your wonderful interview with Mary Pfeiffer, Pythia, you essentially ask her the core question, why, what makes it hard for people to, wake up? And I found her response very interesting in that she said, if I want to understand and help people to this, I have to start by understanding them and caring for them as they are in this moment. She says this is what she would do as a psychotherapist, and this is the approach that she would bring to having that kind of conversation. Can you share a little bit more about, what she has to say and, what was the core of her approach and understanding about how to speak to people who are reluctant to face up to these issues?
Well, I think what I found interesting with Mary Pfeiffer, as I did with every psychologist that I interviewed for this book, is that they don't begin with what should be. They begin with what is and where we are at. Mm-hmm. And I think for real change to happen, that has to be the starting point. So the starting point in my interview with Mary was, I kind of came at this with, why aren't people waking up to this issue? Why aren't they doing more on the environment? This is the most critical issue. This affects our very lives and the very lives of our children, our health and well-being into the future. So her first point was that people don't really respond to kind of these alarmist messages on a psychological level. They kind of tend to shut down. They don't respond to feeling, to being made to feel guilty or for being scolded to. But if they are approached as she would approach someone, as if they were a client who's come into their office, as if they were a client on her couch. And so she kind of went with that and developed that further and began speaking to America. She began speaking to America as a patient. And she said she would start out by saying, I want to really understand this place that you're in. Why is this issue so painful? So her line of thinking was that our defenses are in place around this because it's actually very painful for us to be able to take it in. It's hard for Americans to take in the idea that there not only is this happening to us, but also we're a big part of why it's happening. I mean, America is next to China, the biggest polluter in the world. But what she began to get into also was, she would sort of relate in that emotional way, in that kind of empathetic way, in a non-judgmental way. And then that creates a kind of bond between her and the person. And she began to talk about what she was able to draw on in her own struggle with the Keystone XL pipeline, and that was drawing on certain American myths as a way to help get more people engaged in the struggle. And one of the people she began working with was a kind of conservative Republican, a tall, very Western-looking guy with his jeans and cowboy boots and cowboy hat, and people could immediately relate to him. And so she began to use, you know, they began to work with the idea of the hero, that, you know, this is part of the American language, the hero. I mean, that's one of our major archetypes. And she used what she called, he used what she called our wonderful John Wayne American language. So that was one thing that I found very interesting. The other thing that she talked about was being an example to people in her own life. You know, instead of carrying a plastic bottle, carrying a metal bottle, not using paper bags, putting solar panels on her house. And also using those things as kind of wedges or ways to talk about what she describes, she talks about the environment as being a social taboo, that people can't really talk about it. And she says, but when are we going to talk about it? If not now, then when? So her idea was to begin to talk about it, just through her books, but just with friends and neighborhood gatherings, and to make it kind of a communal activity. So those were some of the things that Mary brought to my understanding of climate change and how she herself is working on the Keystone XL pipeline issue.
Did she mention, or did anyone else mention, why in certain, you know, why is it taboo, you know, how it's become a taboo, or why is it taboo to bring up the environment and talk about
it? I think because immediately people start to feel guilty, that guilt is a big part of it. And we don't like to feel these, that's where we get into the whole psychological territory, because it stirs up these darker emotions and feelings that we're uncomfortable with to begin with. And also, as a country, we're uncomfortable with these darker, uncomfortable, unsettling emotions. So that makes it very hard to talk about something which is such a big issue, which is such a life-threatening issue, and that raises all kinds of anxiety, that stirs fears around our future, that stirs fears around our physical survival. So that's a large part of why it is I'm sorry I forgot to do my call, stop my call waiting, so I'm sorry for the little beep on the phone.
Okay.
But the other thing she brought out was the fact that there's also a lack of really good information in the media, and that the media is not talking about this in the ways that they should be.
That's very true.
With the exception of you and what you're doing, Allison.
Yes, it is. It's connecting the dots and filling in the gaps.
Right.
You know, that brings up another thing that struck me as you were describing, you know, that the fear of survival, the concern for the future, all the fear for our own well-being, all of that, you know, the darker things that are more painful that we want to push out of the way in order to, you know, kind of participate in American life in a certain kind of way. I note that there's also maybe an ethos, and I'd love your thoughts or comments on this, or if any of your people that you spoke with in America on the Couch, you know, spoke to this topic, or if you have any, you know, your own thoughts about it. There tends to be a sense that, you know, of let's say positive psychology in America. Mm-hmm. We want to look on the bright side, think of, mm-hmm. you know, the good things, not get, you know, kind of pull down into, you know, anything that's troubling, because we kind of have to function, we have to get by, we have to succeed, we mm-hmm. want to look on the sunny side of life. I'm just calling that positive psychology. I don't know. I mean, in other words, that's a sort of a sense that psychology or how we feel or act should be positive. There's also a field called positive psychology. I don't mm-hmm. know that I see a lot of its proponents in this book. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on both
lacking,
the attitudes
yes.
of positive psychology and also the forms of that expressions of a popular, you know, positive psychology take in the popular discourse and the popular media and everything.
Well,
because that would play into what you're describing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right, and it's not only positive psychology. I would take that in a much larger world view that defines who we are as Americans. Mm-hmm. As Americans, we are by nature forward-looking. We are always seeking out the horizon. We're way more interested in the future than we are in the past. We want the next new, bright, shiny thing. It's kind of ingrained in who we are. And so what's difficult for us is to look back at the past and to slow down and to look at these more troubling sides of within ourselves, the feelings that we're feeling, and also what's going on in the culture. So that's a big part of the problem, is just our positive psychology that is who we are as a people, and is really not doing us that much good when it comes to dealing with the environment. But there are a couple of ways in which the parts of that side of the American character can work for us. And that several environmentalists, when I spoke with them, and I said, what are those parts of the American character can we draw on to help us? And one of them was that can-do spirit. You know, mm-hmm. we've always had that, well, when times get tough, then, you know, we can have this can-do spirit. You know, we have this kind of frontier settler part of our American character that's, you know, that's based on our past, based on our history. We can draw on those parts of ourselves in dealing with the environmental crisis. There's also, as Mary Pfeiffer pointed out, the whole community aspect of America, the whole idea of community potlucks and towns coming together and working together, the whole idea of in our pioneer past, you know, barn raisings. And when you study the origins of the American Revolution, it's so interesting that it was the focus was so much on the individual, because it was such a communal effort of all the states coming together and all the founding fathers coming together and all the people coming together to create a country. So we do have that kind of can-do spirit and that kind of communal part of ourselves that I think we can draw on.
That's very interesting. Yeah. So that's a resource for stepping into. Yeah. That's
right.
That's fascinating.
And also, those are for people who are environmental activists. I think those are resources to draw on in terms of coming up with images and languages and ways of communicating to the American people around the environment.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, you know, one of the things that we is kind of a truism, but I call it a bad jacket that's hung on activists, is that the motivation for activism or the inner emotional state of activists is, one of anger. And so, it's like, well, I don't want to be angry, so I don't want to look at this, and activists are all angry. And, there is some, on the one hand, I think there is some truth that there is a level of outrage married to concern, and compassion and worry, and sadness about, so I think there's actually a range of different of the, emotions kind of bound up with activism. And I say that from my own personal experience and of working with others. But there's another side of activism, which is the one you're just describing, which is the community spirit, the getting together, the let's get involved, the let's do this together. And there is a sense of community that builds around activism that is actually, I know there are other forms of social gathering and interest in American life, anything from faith group activities to sports activities to cultural activities, that draw people who are interested in them together. But there's certainly that element in activist activities. I was just this last weekend at a delightful country event attended by, hundreds and hundreds of people, hosted by Mark Ruffalo and focused on energy solutions, getting better energy systems in place so that we, use less fossil fuels and don't contribute to accelerating climate change in that way. And it was just like all multiple communities of people showed up for that, and everyone was drinking artisanal beer, and supporting this cause. And so, it was a lot of fun. So there is that side of it as well,
Yes, and as Raymond DeYoung, one of the other people who was an environmental psychologist at the University of Michigan, in our interview, which was titled How to Adapt to the Coming Downshift, which is inevitable, he talked a lot about food and also and how the whole idea of local, going to farmers' markets, and making food even part of conversation at social gatherings, just like you were talking about your artisanal beer and talking perhaps about the strawberry jam that you made or the gardening you did with your son or grandson. So I think those are wonderful ways that it's begun to already become woven into us, I think, as a country, I hope.
Yeah, and joining together to protect your community and the earth can be part of that. Well, let's shift gears for a moment and, pick up another theme, because this, your book, America on the Couch, it just has so much, so many different threads. And so let's go to another one, because we were just talking about, the various emotions. And you did an interview with Harriet Lerner on the politics of anxiety. And, I just found this particular, she's a long-term senior clinical psychologist, highly regarded. And I found this particular essay so interesting, one, because as mentioned, I think that anxiety what's going on in our world is like a kind of natural response to the things that we've just been discussing. But her point is that it's built into the political system. And I thought that was rather fascinating because, we tend to regard the political system as we find it or see it as a kind of given. It's going on out there. It's terrible in one way or another. It's hopeful in one way or another. But we sort of, we don't think about how our participation in that system, which, and I'm certainly not ever, would I never would be someone who would say, disengage for the sake of your mental well-being or anything like that. That would never be my particular message. I feel people should become more engaged. But mm-hmm. to do that and to spend one's, you know, the time that one has to focus on citizen behavior as opposed to fulfilling the other roles that we have in our lives, because that time is, you know, for most people, somewhat delimited, it seems like understanding where to constructively contribute and other arenas where there are things, in, forces in place or things in place that are kind of playing us in some kind of way or that we have an emotional reaction to, the psychological reaction to, that we're not, that just seems like a given, but that is really part of the way a particular kind of game or system is playing out. I found her her conversation with you very, very interesting in terms of anxiety as a prime feature of the political system. Can you comment on that?
Well, yes. I thought she was very interesting also talking about anxiety, and I thought it was something we should all know about. We should all be educated in this, as you were just saying, in this idea that anxiety is such a part of our democracy, and as another person I interviewed, Murray Stein, brought up, anxiety is a part of democracy and freedom. It comes with being an American citizen, and it's something that we peaks especially around election time, and people become very anxious around who our president is going to be, because whoever we choose as our president is whoever is going to be the face of America and how we present ourselves to the world. And also what Harriet Lerner talked about in terms of how anxiety works in a political system is that once it gets into a system, it drives polarities. And I thought that was very interesting to learn in the sense because our polarity, the polarization between our two parties has really worsened over my lifetime. And she attributes a lot of that to this kind of underlying anxiety that's kind of running through the American psyche. And I think that at the same time, so she really describes how it works. It polarizes us, and then it also acts in a way that when a person starts to feel anxiety, the first thing that they try to do is they try and pass it off or dump it on somebody else. And so it kind of is a very negative, self-perpetuating kind of negative emotion, but that is just part of the human condition as well.
How do people try to pass it? What would be an example of people passing it along to somebody else?
Well, she talks about how we manage anxiety and how if we're not managing our own anxiety, it creates increasingly high levels of tension around us. And it also, you might... Well, I'm trying to think of a very of an example. She uses the example of a mother and father who've gone into therapy because they both have a concern over their child. And rather than sit with their own fear around their anxiety for their child who's having some kind of a problem, they kind of instantly fall into blaming the other. The mother brain blames the father for not being hands-on enough. The father blames the mother for being too hands-on and overprotective. And I think that's an example that she uses in how people can, rather than hold their anxiety, they because it's so uncomfortable and it's so hard to feel anxiety, I'm sure all your listeners and even you yourself are familiar what that's like to feel this great anxiety. And we don't want to feel it. So we either project it onto another person. We do whatever we can to get rid of it, which goes for a lot of other unpleasant, dark emotions. And I think that's one of the things that psychology actually, in individual therapy, that's what we learn to do. We learn to hold to contain, to understand our own uncomfortable, unsettling feelings. And I think as an American, the American political system, somebody said somebody should send my book to someone in Congress, that it should be required reading. And I thought this one in particular, my interview with Harriet Lerner, would be required reading because of the way it kind of runs through a political system and in very negative and destructive ways.
Mm-hmm. Yet one thing that occurs to me is I had posted something on my Facebook thread. I do a lot of social media on Facebook for anyone who wants to come and sign up on my Facebook page, Connecting the Dots for Health. But, you know, I posted something and about Hillary that wasn't, you know, it wasn't hypercritical, but it raised some issues. I mean, her stand or lack of a clear stand and, you know, obfuscation on the environment, you know, is clearly one of them for those of us who are concerned about the environment. And someone else became, you know, I thought this was a perfect example of the kind of anxiety that we're speaking of here, political anxiety, was very concerned. You know, I mean, there's a lot of fear on among people who are liberal or Democrats or whatever that Republican could be elected, and, you know, undo Obamacare or whatever. And there was just a kind of lack, a sense of lack of options. And we do, you know, have another Democratic candidate running in Bernie Sanders right now. And, you know, a lot of people are, you know, very emotionally invested in him, his success, and believe that, you know, he could win. There are others who dismiss him and say he can't win. There's fear that if, you know, that he would splinter the party, as happened with Ralph Nader, although he, running as a Democrat, would either be the nominee or not. You know, so, I mean, this to me was a prime example of the level of fear after all that we've been through on these various presidential campaigns. It always seems to get worse. Now, I just wanted you to maybe define a little bit for our listeners what you mean by polarization and how anxiety feeds that specifically for people who may not understand that term, to get like a sort of more vivid picture of like what we're talking about, for example.
Well, I'm actually talking about the political polarization that between conservatives and liberals, Republicans and Democrats, the whole cultural divide that began from what I studied about this. It began to really worsen in the 60s when these big cultural issues started to come up around feminism. I think that's what I'm referring to is political polarization.
So in other words, just to put it in, you know, sort of the dumbest possible language, it's kind of like the opposites become more and more opposite with less of a zone of an area of shared agreement between them.
Right. Yes.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Yeah. And actually, we're noting this for any, you know, younger listeners as well, because this wasn't always the case. I mean, there used to be shared areas of agreement. We don't agree about this. We prefer to handle this that way. But, you know, around these things, we're all in agreement. But, you know, now there's sort of less and less and less and less and less that people are, you know, there's not a zone of mutual agreement. Like the zone of mutual agreement, for example, used to encompass things like, well, we may want to treat the economy differently, but we all support the education of our children, the health care of the population. We want there to be, you know, good highways. I mean, you know, there might be things that would have been regarded in the past as not the property of any one party, but as kind of politically neutral, you know. But there's less and less of that, and that means actually that the zone of politicization, the zone of things that we are troubled by and in opposition to someone else about, has increased, while the zone of neutrality and shared agreement has decreased. And that in and of itself would increase anxiety, wouldn't it?
Well, I actually think that polarization has always been a part of the American psyche and the American political system. Because it was there from the very beginning I mean, you saw that in the relationship between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, who started out as great friends and companions in the common cause. And yet, as they began to set up and construct this new country and government, they had very different ideas. Mm-hmm. Adams could be called was more of a federalist and a strong government guy, and Jefferson was more the liberal, democratic representative of just let the people, you know, he didn't want very much government. So I mm-hmm. think it's always been there, but to varying degrees. So it kind of peaks and then simmers down. And I, you know, Murray Stein, who is a Jungian analyst that I interviewed for this book, when I talked to him around the last election cycle, and he said, you know, are these elections and politics is a blood sport in America. It's not for the faint of heart. And it does require a certain, I want to say toughness, but maybe it's really an acceptance, as I said, of what is and not how it should be, that we're not mm-hmm. always going to get along, and especially in the political arena. Mm-hmm. And I have mostly very liberal friends, I also have a lot of conservative friends, and I'm very surprised sometimes when I get together with my liberal friends. I've sometimes asked this question: Do they have any conservative friends? And they very rarely do. So I think that it's something that we could talk about and discuss as an issue in America today. And part of that comes back to anxiety, because I think when we find ourselves talking about these very charged issues, like around abortion, for instance, or the environment where people are on very opposite sides, or just like what you went through with your Facebook post, it brings up these very deep feelings of anxiety and unsettledness, and people are passionate about it.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that is really true. And I think it's very helpful to do what you're doing in America on the Couch and sort of talk about these substrates, because we all experience them, and this mm-hmm. kind of gives a voice to that. Now, mm-hmm. just to shift gears from anxiety, we're sort of taking a tour of the negative emotions here a little bit, but it's also through various important facets of American life.
You're so brave to do this, Allison.
What was that?
You're so brave to do this. I appreciate it so much.
Well, I really appreciate this book. Just want to say to listeners once again, America on the Couch by Pythia Pia, Pythia, last name is Peay, and it really is like a Bible. So if you're ever, you know, out there wondering, how can I talk to this person, or how can I understand why this is happening, how can we do this better, how can we bridge things and understand what's going on with people here, you know, this is the book for you, is all I can say, and I hope that you will buy it. It's not a book that you're going to sit down and read from cover to cover, probably. But there are many, many essays, dozens of them, by really thoughtful people that you can kind of, you know, dip into and read, you know, them at various times. And they all really enrich insight, as you can see from these examples of our talking about certain of these interviews. Now, we're going to move on and talk about your interview with psychoanalyst and psychohistorian Charles B. Strozier. Mm-hmm. And I was particularly fascinated by this essay because he was in Greenwich Village at the time of the 9/11 World Trade Center towers collapse, mm-hmm. and I was in Manhattan, albeit uptown, at the same time, and mm-hmm. I thought his insights were fascinating. Mm-hmm. And 9/11, both for people who are in New York, but for our entire country and the world, really, I think can rightly be called a kind of turning point mm-hmm. in modern history that, you know, we have all lived through. It's now 14 years ago, and, you know, very powerful changes have occurred in our country, in our foreign policy, in our politics, and in our own sense of ourselves, our country, and our safety ever since that event. So let's talk a bit about his insight into that. One of the things that he said, which I found fascinating and really important, and this again is for the, you know, from the New York perspective, I'll be interested whether other listeners feel that too. And that is zones of sadness. You know,
right.
We experience a lot of different events that are going on in the world that are either near or far. And this is something that, being in the media, you know, I notice a great deal. Being in New York City at the time of 9/11, I was right in a very close zone of sadness. I have actually never seen imagery, film or television imagery of this event since that time. I didn't see it on television. I experienced it by being there and knowing other people who were there. That's a different zone of sadness from someone who sees it somewhere else and, you know, has a different reaction. Same thing with Fukushima. When Fukushima, the terrible tsunami and the nuclear accident that occurred there, you know, I think for many Americans this was like something quite far away, you know, in a different zone of concern than their immediate one. For me, I happened to have been on the phone with a Japanese colleague that very day and had been making planning a trip to Japan. So, you know, so for me that was, I felt much closer to that particular event than I otherwise would have done. So what does Strozier have to tell us about zones of sadness and how that speaks and what that means, the understanding of that means for us?
Well, he said that for those people like you who were in very, you know, right there at the center of things happening, well, he said in general there were two responses. There was to the event, immediate responses. One was anger and one was rage. And he said that anger was the emotion that people who were right there is what they experienced, and that rage was what the rest of the country experienced. So he differentiated between anger and rage because he said anger is in a sense implying it was the healthier one emotion to feel because it's more directed, while rage is more diffuse and undifferentiated. And so much more dangerous in a political sense because as he goes on to explain, that rage was easily manipulated and appropriated by the Bush administration to use as a premise or a pretext for going to war in Iraq. And so that was one of the ways in which he talked about the zone of sadness.
Mm-hmm. Do you see other ways in which that concept is applicable to things going on in our lives and world?
That's very interesting. I'd have to think about that. Well, I'm sure we could think about that in terms of what our soldiers are experiencing at war in Iraq, what they experience at war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and where they're the ones who are actually suffering, really suffering, not just wounds to their bodies, but wounds to their psyches, and they're coming home with PTSD, so that there's now an epidemic of PTSD with our American soldiers. And that's a very different experience than the American people who sent them off to war. We don't have to be there in the thick of battle. We don't have to, except for those parents who lose their sons and daughters to war, we don't really lose anyone. We don't know what that experience is like to be in battle and to have your comrade next to you die or be shot and killed in front of your eyes. So I think that's an example. And I think probably that shifts their experience around what war is.
Mm-hmm. So it's a whole different experience of war. So we might have, the average American might have a more indistinct idea of what their reality of war is. I actually recall a conversation with, you know, a man who was a landlord in a building that I lived in at one time. Actually, very nice man, and, you know, albeit that our politics were not the same at all. He was a retired, I think, New York City policeman who now ran a bar in a particular neighborhood and owned this building where I lived, and we had a very cordial relationship. Moved out of that building, ran into him on the street of New York before the whole 911 thing happened, and he said something, I think it was in the prior election, you know, the first Bush election, and he basically said that he was planning to vote for Bush because to send a message, he said, to them over there. And, you know, we're talking about zones of sadness or, you know, different zones of experiencing things that are going on in our world. You know, he had some kind of more acute concern, but at the same time, a fairly generalized concern because there was no real political activity, notable political activity going on at the time. And I was rather struck when he said them over there,
right,
because I wasn't at all concerned about it. So on the one hand, somebody's them over there might be, you know, I am much more worried about foreign people and what they may be doing to us at some point in time than, you know, what, than a lot of people would have felt later, you know, a year or two later after 9/11.
Right.
On the other hand, we may kind of regard wars as them over there, you know, the voice
right.
over there, without, you know, a real close-up impression of the damage, such as experienced either by the you know the military themselves, their families, the therapists who work with them, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think it's an interesting comment that he made, and I think it touches on something else in my interview with Strozier mm-hmm. about 9/11, mm-hmm. and practically everybody that I interviewed for the book who talked about 9/11 as a significant trauma to the American psyche,
mm-hmm.
and that because we are such a new country and we have this kind of fragile identity,
mm-hmm.
we kind of come off all very strong and blustery, but underneath it all, we're still not quite cohering together. We still have a lot of work to build to have a strong identity as a country. So 9/11 came along, and it was a trauma to us, and we have been experiencing what he calls kind of a cultural form of PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
And he said it triggered, because we have this weak identity, because it was a trauma, it triggered a rage reaction in us, which
mm-hmm.
then is what led to these wars in Iraq. So, and it also played into what he calls this part of the American psyche, this strain in our historical character that dates back to Columbus. This kind of deep narrative that runs deep in our American psyche around the apocalypse
mm-hmm.
and how the underlying everything is this apocalyptic strain around the end of the world, and that Christopher Columbus, when I thought he was coming for riches and spoils, but he corrected me on that and said, in fact, Christopher Columbus came here because he felt that the world was going to end in 1650, and mm-hmm. they needed to find a new Garden of Eden, a new place. So he said when 9/11 happened, he said, and he felt kind of guilty for saying this, but, you know, compared to events like the Civil War, or even, I think Hurricane Katrina, more people have died in other events than died on that day, 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
But he said it became a very huge event for us because it played into our apocalyptic fears around the end of the world, and that many people experienced it as an end of the world kind of scenario. And
mm-hmm.
even I share with him in my interview, when we're discussing, I mean, I remember that day very vividly, and I remember running outside, and I remember thinking it was the end and that bombs would be dropping from the sky soon. So even I've kind of found myself drawn into that, you know, out completely unbidden. It just kind of welled up in me. So I think that was another important part of 911. And again, it was something that was easily able, these kind of apocalyptic fears, the post-traumatic stress, the trauma to our identity was something that was easily manipulated and appropriated by the people in power at the time.
So, you know, if we could channel that into this war action, which it turns out was completely inappropriate and deceptive and wrong target, you know, somehow then, you know, that it became the all of the feelings you're describing became the fuel with that as the offered resolution to those feelings. And that, so in a sense, all of the traumatic responses were manipulated, you know, into this fake resolution, which in fact didn't resolve either the feelings or the situation or anything. So, you know, in fact, we're still living in the aftermath of that without without real resolution concerning it. Would you say that would be so? Or
absolutely. He said it created a double trauma. So in on top of the trauma of 911, these double wars created another trauma, so that it was a double trauma. The other thing that that Strozier brought up, and that ties into the kind of apocalyptic fears around 911, is America's role. Everything kind of links back. I mean, that's what happens in psychology and the study of the psyche. There's kind of these ever-deepening layers. And so we have the apocalyptic fears that have been a deep strain in the American psyche. But then there's also the fears that we have around nuclear weapons that Strozier talked about, and that also Robert J. Liston talked about very powerfully, and how, you know, now that we've actually used nuclear weapons, and Americans were the first to use nuclear weapons, and so we suffer a lot of unrecognized and unacknowledged guilt around that, and Liston described that as a kind of wound in the American psyche. And it gave rise to what Strozier describes as this idea of endism, that now with nuclear weapons in the world, God doesn't have to end the world. We can do it ourselves. So it's a very powerful thing that was unleashed with America's decision to use atomic weapons at the end of World War II, and it continues to kind of resonate, especially around 911.
That's so interesting. And just to connect the dots a little further on this tale, I can't resist doing this. Because interestingly, I mean, interesting, it's not intellectually interesting, you know, as in, oh, what an interesting, you know, whatever. It's kind of like a horrible synchronicity and, you know, awful coincidence, or maybe it's not a coincidence. But New York, you know, the site of all of this, that, you know, that both 911 and is also, you know, it's also the place where we have a nuclear power plant north of the city, and New York City is in the zone of breach were there to be any kind of event at that plant. It's at Indian Point, about half an hour north of the city, and they're building a high-pressure gas pipeline has been approved to be built on the grounds of this nuclear plant, and there's a very high percentage of explosion risks with high-pressure gas pipelines because of what they're made of, because of error, because of various things. And so, you know, people are desperately trying to get their elected officials to, you know, reverse a ruling by an agency that's funded by the gas pipeline industry, you know, but making governmental decisions, you know, to put this in place. And I have written an article about it. I've had the people who were the activist organization on this front on the program in the past. And the article is on Alternet. If you Google my name, Allison Rose Levy, and Alternet, it's called Why on Earth Did the Feds Approve a High-Pressure Gas Pipeline Near a Nuke Plant? And it goes through, you know, all the dangers and everything. But the reason I'm mentioning this is because when I had done this article, which I did very carefully and very neutrally, despite the fact that I sometimes, you know, cross that line, in this case I just felt the information spoke for itself. It was so important. I did it very neutrally, and I approached several colleagues who were on major, mainstream newspapers thinking, you know, this is actually... If this occurs and there's the probability of an occurrence is far beyond the legal limit, far as evaluated by independent scientists who are familiar with all of this, and this is detailed in the article. But I approached these, you know, colleagues in these publications because I felt it deserved a wider read because it would affect the entire New York region. And the interesting thing, going back to this zones conversation that we were having earlier, is that in both cases the people said, oh, well, that's just a local issue in the suburb of New York, and, you know, the New York Times, for example, or, you know, other mainstream publications would not be interested in a local story. So it's interesting that through the media we also have a very distorted sense of what is local.
Of what is local, that's right. Well, I know. I think, well, one of the things that stirs your, I'm sorry, were you going to say something? Or
No, you go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. What it brings to mind is something else that Stosur talked about, something that he called the new violence, and it has to do with this whole idea of distance, and that violence, the kind of forms of warfare in modern times are warfare that's done at a distance, like with Hiroshima, right, where a bomb was dropped. So then the plane flew on, and Paul Tibbetts was not on the ground to see, you know, the extreme suffering and pain and death that was caused by this bomb. And so, and Stosur talks about how this kind of new violence, now we have drone strikes, you know, things that are done from bombs that are dropped from above.
So we are able to actually kind of, I'm going to have to interrupt you because I just got a signal from the engineer that we're nearing the end of our thing. But it's kind of like the power of technology is creating a dissociation about how
that's
near
exactly,
or far.
It's exactly what, that's the, exactly the word that's used, is that there's a dissociation. And they actually, he actually talks about it in previous centuries when you killed someone, you plunged a sword, it sounds very gory and awful, but you plunged a sword into that person's chest, you saw their eyes close. So there were feelings, natural instinctive feelings of guilt and suffering.
And we don't have the proximity to have any of that, and yet we are carrying the effects of it. Now I'm going to have to wrap us up here, and
okay,
I want to get in one last plug for this wonderful book, America on the Couch by Pythia Pei. You can find it on Amazon.com. You know, highly suggested reading. You can also pick up her other book, which we'll discuss in a future show, American Icarus, A Memoir of Father and Country. Fascinating book about her father, a veteran of World War II. Thank you so much for being with me today, Pythia. This has been a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for this tremendous work of doing this and your other book as well.
Well, thank you, and thank you for having me on as a guest, and thank you for all the work that you do as well. I appreciate it so very much.
Thank you. And thank you, listeners, for being with us. Go out and get America on the Couch and tune in next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time for Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Have a great week. Be well.